Hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. The Savvy Painter Podcast is published every week on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, iHeartRadio, and SoundCloud. If you are a painter or artist who is looking for down-to-earth, real-life conversations about art, how to create it, how to sell it, you are in the right place. Savvy Painter has been downloaded over a million times by artists in 150 countries. This is the place where you will find your community, you will be inspired to create, and you'll hear real stories from artists who are thriving with their art. So if you are new to this podcast, I want to welcome you to the Savvy Painter community. But make sure you don't miss an episode. Sign up for weekly updates, free guides, and workshop announcements. Go to savvypainter.com and click on join. It's that easy. Trakel Art Supplies is sponsoring this episode. Trakel offers sensibly priced art supplies conveniently shipped to your door. For over 30 years, Trakel has been obsessed with the art of brush making. They have been testing and tweaking their brushes to get the perfect balance, flow, and snap. And from now until July 20th, when you use promo code SAVVYGIFT, you get a free number 6 round golden Taclon brush to try out. So head over to trakel.com, that's T-R-E-K-E-L-L.com, and use the promo code SAVVYGIFT at checkout, and Trakel's gonna toss in that free paintbrush for you along with your order. Julian Merrow-Smith is a British painter living in Provence in the south of France. In February 2005, Julian started Postcard from Provence, a daily painting project at shiftinglight.com. He's completed over 2,600 daily paintings. Postcard from Provence has been featured in the New York Times, The Times, USA Today, The Guardian, and The Sunday Telegraph. Julian has been selected not once but twice for the BP Portrait Award at the National Portrait Gallery in London. He has also shown at the Royal Society of Portrait Painters in London and was selected for the New Contemporaries exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art in London as well. In this episode, Julian and I talk about a whole host of delightful painting topics. We talk about optimism and pessimism in painting, how his personality dictates his painting style, the importance of diligent practice, lifelong learning, and continual improvement, some of my favorite topics, and, of course, how we can be kind to ourselves as artists. Not only that, but Julie and I both realize that we will be in Italy at the same time, so we actually get to meet each other in person. This is so exciting. I can't wait for that. So here we go. I am so happy to introduce you to Julian Merrow-Smith. Julian, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast. I am delighted to finally get you on the show.
It's an absolute pleasure.
I would love to hear a little bit about you and your work and how you got started as an artist. For the two people out there who have no idea who you are, please enlighten us.
Oh, come on. I moved to France 18 years ago now and I'd taken redundancy in London and moved out here. A friend invited me and I only bought a one-way ticket, and his wife very quickly found me somewhere to stay.
How kind of her.
It wasn't a house. And yeah, I started painting then, really. I mean, I'd started in London a few years before. You know, I went to art school a long time ago and stuff, but I was a conceptual artist. I never repainted. I eschewed all that kind of artisanal thing and wanted to be a great intellect, you know, like, yeah, right. So when I came here, I started to really learn to paint.
So you were, make sure I understand this correctly, you were trained as a conceptual artist.
Well, I went to art school in the late 70s, so they didn't teach you anything. There was stuff available. And most of the painting that was going on, there was some figurative, but it was mostly, there was a life model. She wandered around in a kimono and nobody ever seemed to use her.
So, okay, so that's really interesting. So you had this conceptual background, which you feel like taught you absolutely nothing about art.
Well, no, I mean, I knew a lot about art, but I mean, it wasn't a lot about technical stuff other than, the things I needed, photography and other things. So I did stuff. In England, you have to go through a you do a year's training first, where you do everything. You do 3D design, you do graphics, you do painting and pottery and so on. Then you choose which you're going to do, degree level. So I went off to, so that was the last time I had painted up till 1999. So between 1977 and 1999, I didn't paint at all.
What did you do?
I did a lot of laying down in fields and taking photographs of myself. I wrote my thesis on Richard Long. And then, you know, I kind of got involved in kind of boring things, you know, buying houses and doing boring jobs.
By that, do you mean non-art related jobs? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, really. Until I started running I used to run cinemas. I was working in a cinema and then I eventually ran cinemas for a small company in London. So I initially took the job to work at cinemas so I could paint and never really did. And then I eventually ended up running the cinema in Chelsea in the King's Road and I started employing lots of painters. And then I started going to openings again and Pete Doig was regularly cycling past and popping in to say hello to his friends and, the guy whose painting's going for $33 million.
Oh, that Peter Doig.
So I was kind of hanging around with those guys and I started going to openings and getting interested again. And I saw a show by an English painter, Ivan Hitchens, at the Serpentine in London, and I just had never seen anything like it. Very kind of abstract landscapes. I just loved them, and I started painting. And then there was Lucian Freud at the time, was very big, and I started painting myself. And then eventually I started painting myself a lot, and then I took this redundancy and came down here. And then when I came down here, I was about to be, I think I was 39 when I came down here. And I wanted to get into the BP, which at the time you had to be under 40. And so I had a year and I put a painting in, spent a few months doing this painting and put it in for the BP and got in. And that was my first going to the National Portrait Gallery and go to the opening and so on. And
at this time, were you living in France then or were you still in England? Okay.
Yeah. I've been here for about a year when I did that. Yeah. So. I'll let you get the word in edgeways. I do apologize.
I'll just shout over you. You know, us Americans, you know how we are. When I want your attention, I will get it, Julian.
Okay, fine.
So, for people who are listening, it's because prior to this conversation, we were making jokes about British communication styles versus communication styles from the US, and we people from the US have this somehow, I don't know how we got it, we have this, people think we're loud, I don't get it.
This undeserved reputation.
I know, it's offensive. No,
but it was you that said it, not me. So.
It was me who said it. I will own it. My husband tells me all the time, like, oh my god, you guys are so loud. So you moved to France, and then you had to quickly, within 1 year, get into the BP Portrait Awards.
Yeah.
Kudos to you for doing that and getting in there. But I'm kind of curious. So you said you were going to these art openings and seeing these paintings that really sound like they inspired you in London, that inspired you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why the move to France?
That was just a redundancy. So I had a bit of money and I'd been painting sort of in my spare room. And I had a friend who had gone to this foundation art college with. Mm-hmm. He went off to Oxford and did English instead, deciding art wasn't for him. But we've stayed great friends and he's been a great supporter. And he was here. He'd written a very successful novel and he'd initially left London for the Cayman Islands. And they lasted 6 months and then came to here. Looking for sunshine. And so he invited me down, rent a friend. So I came down and I stayed. He eventually went off to Hollywood and I stayed here. As is the way of these things.
Isn't it?
Very strange. So I got marooned here.
Well, it doesn't sound like you've been suffering.
No. So he was great. He was a great supporter and he bought paintings early on. So that was how I was making my living, just with him buying the odd painting.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So I have a lot to thank him for.
Yeah. Yeah. And his wife too, it sounds like, for finding you a place to live.
Yes.
So tell me about what, you know, so you get there and you hadn't been painting for a long time and you become interested in these sort of abstract landscape paintings. It sounds like at that point you pretty much had to teach yourself how to paint since you didn't get a lot of instruction in college.
Yeah, I can remember the things that had been spoken about. I can remember some of the things that had been said to my girlfriend at the time back at art college, but no, I'd never really had any sort of instruction in painting. So I did the usual thing. I got all the books, and it was pre-internet, you know, 1998. So, yeah, books and trial and error.
Looking back at it now, after however many years that is.
Yeah, for 20 years, yeah.
What were some of the things that you did that you think were particularly useful in teaching yourself how to paint?
There's no way around it. You just got to do it. You just got to do it again and again and again. You know, I think it was maybe on your podcast the other day. Somebody was saying that one of the things about painting is that through painting you learn every day. If you're painting a day, I mean, however long it takes you to do a painting, you're kind of learning what you don't want to do. So kind of every painting is kind of like, yep, that's not what I wanted. And so you're kind of, it's a search for forever, for trying to get somewhere. But I think that, just mileage, you just got to keep. That's the only way around it, Unfortunately, I think it's always kind of disappointing. I do say this to my students quite a lot, and they go, I can't believe you said that, but you're invariably put up against your own limitations. If you paint every day, you'll be put up against your limitations every day. And there are obviously days when it goes well, and there are days when you kind of know what you did yesterday that you want to solve, and there are days when you're just tired and it just doesn't go very well.
Yeah.
Work. That's all you can do.
Right.
And listen to people.
All of the above. But I think that you're right. The simple thing that few people want to hear is that if the best advice you could possibly get to improve your painting is to get your butt in front of an easel and paint.
Yeah,
and it is that simple.
Yeah.
And it's that way, I think, like that is something that is the no nonsense answer to everything. Like, how do I get into a gallery? How do I do this? How do I do that? You paint.
Yeah. What kind of artist do I want to be? Oh my God, just paint.
How do I find my, how would you answer that question? I get this very often. How do I find my voice?
Yeah. My wife has been playing the cello since she was 4. And she's, 50-something, and I'm not allowed to say, probably. So, that's a long time. That's a lot of practice, a lot of dedicated, deliberate practice. And if you start at painting at 40, there's a slight disadvantage, that's for sure.
Do you think so?
Yeah. I mean, my wife at 40, she'd already had 36 years of practice. If I start painting at 40, it's, she's 36 years ahead of me. That's a lifetime. That's, that's only half a lifetime. That's a long time.
It is. I'm always noticing that there's sort of a caveat to that, as with everything, that I would agree if it's 36 years of diligent practice. But oftentimes I think people can do the same thing over and over again without really realizing that they're doing the same thing over again and feel like they're putting their hours in, but they're not getting anywhere. And what's wrong with this picture? So sometimes I think the maturity can be helpful, or the urgency that comes with it.
Yes. I mean, it's true that if late starters can go a long way by really practicing in a very, very controlled and deliberate way. But, if you're a professional cellist, you're doing that anyway. There's not really,
true.
The greatest orchestras in the world. And, it's not like, there's no real sitting around, fiddling. Ooh, there's a bit of a pun there. A friend of my wife's came on one of the workshops. And he's a cellist. And he's just retired from, he was head cello of a major London orchestra. And, of course, he wants to paint. He's been collecting paintings and... but I'm an age and he wants to be as good at painting as he was on the channel. Now, mm-hmm. You start in your late 60s or whatever, it's difficult. You know, you are at a disadvantage. You can be very good. I mean, you know, but there's an awful lot of work to do. And nobody goes on a 5-day or 10-day or weekend workshop to learn how to play the violin. They don't do it. Where would you be?
True. Well, they do. I think they try. They want that. And then they're just sorely disappointed when all the neighbors are pounding on the wall, begging them to stop.
I mean, those kind of things are very good for honing techniques and seeing how other people do things and so on. But anyway, I didn't mean to be depressingly kind of don't even bother if you're older than 4. But, you know, obviously there's an advantage if, you know, you see there's some great painters out there and you see what they did when they were 16, 17 and, you know, they did amazing work.
Tell me a little bit about your process and how you work then. What is it when you're in your studio or you're outside painting? Tell me how you start your day.
I'm a great putter off of things. So I tend to be, I've got a studio that faces east, so the light comes in, so it's pretty useless before kind of midday. I've got a bright sunlight coming in most of the time. So I tend to deal with the stuff I have to deal with of running a small business, you know, in the mornings and work in the afternoon. But I am a terrible procrastinator. I often have to go out and find something to paint, or I've got a plan. So I often kind of work quite seasonally. So I've got, you know, the things that are happening around me. I live in the middle of the countryside here. So at the minute, you know, peaches have just come into season and I'm painting peaches this week mostly. And, you know, I can set up a still life and I can find some interesting light and work on the things I didn't do so well yesterday. And so I'm fairly kind of safe in what I'm doing.
What is it that inspires you to paint?
What else would I do? No, I mean, there are many things. I actually think it's a really good habit to get into. Clearly it's that when I'm in front of a particular thing, setting up a still life or out in the countryside, then it's light, you know, it's just light. Basically, you sit down, you move the stuff around, and then there'll be a moment when, you know, the light does something wonderful and all you've got to do is sit down and try and capture it, which is the difficult thing, of course.
When you're in those places where you're not particularly inspired or you're getting tired of painting peaches, for example, what do you do?
Yeah, you know, change it up. Go and paint by the river or something. We've been trying to go most years in the autumn now to Venice, for example. It's just a really nice change after a summer, you know, painting here, and just to be around boats and water and so on, for example, is great. Or we go to the seaside or some, you know, place. I mean, one of the lucky things that I have here is that I'm 3.5 hours from the Italian and the Spanish borders, you know, so I can be in Barcelona or you know, Genoa or whatever in 4 hours.
So you're in the south of France?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Marseille is about an hour around. So there's always something I can do to get up and shoot around. And because it's very easy to travel with painting kits and I've got it down to a, you know, fine art of a small box and small amount of paint and so on, I can, you know, I can pretty well take it with me wherever I go. So we tend to do quite a lot of holidays together which are designed around me being able to paint. That's very handy.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. Can you describe your paint kit?
Yeah, I've got a fair few different paint kits, but generally what I've been using is Ben Haggett's Prima Poche boxes, which are great just because all the kit just fits inside. So I've got, I keep all my paints and so on.
What is it?
He's a guy in Montana. It's called Alla Prima Pochard, and he makes these wonderful handmade boxes full of magnets and magic, but they hold, you know, 4 boards and all the paints and so, and fit on a tripod, and they're very neat for traveling. I've got a tiny little one, which is 8x6. Well, I've got 20 of those that I use for my workshop. You know, they're 10x8s. And then I have a couple of more things too that I use. And I've just got some Nuka Italy, which so I can paint bigger. But it all comes from America, of course. All the good plein air kit comes from America, which is a pain for us people that live over here in Europe, but at least it's available.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine. Like I remember that from when I was in Argentina, that if you have to import something, it's quite the nightmare.
Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, if you go to a go to England and see people like Ken Howard. They're still using Julian boxes and things, and it's quite difficult to get the kit. But luckily, I have good relationships with people in the States that provide me with the equipment, as I'm providing a workshop, so I've got quite a lot of it. So
yeah,
I'm a big purchaser of kit. Even as far as I now tube my own paints in tiny tubes, and I bought 5,000 paint tubes from China. So I buy big 200 mil things of expensive colors and put them in small tubes.
Really?
For my workshops, yeah. I'll show you them.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see them.
Yeah, I provide all the equipment because I'm a control freak, possibly, but it's also just that if you know they're using the same things as you, then, you know, it just makes it so much easier to teach, because you're teaching exactly what you do, not necessarily style-wise, but, you know, that you can show them how these things work. And so most people that come here for my workshops are looking for, you know, obviously something that I do particularly, that they see in my work, and they want to somehow either incorporate that or, you know, an action or whatever. And so if I'm providing all that kit, it's very good from my point of view and hopefully good from theirs.
Yeah. So I'm curious also, when you started, so you taught yourself how to paint and you started to have some success with it, it sounds like. When did you decide that you wanted to start teaching workshops, and what was it that sort of got you on that track?
Yeah, I've been asked quite a lot to teach, and I thought I would be more likely to take workshops and give them, feeling always somewhat kind of inadequate in my abilities and so on, and still do. Actually, I was ganged up by my wife and a friend, and they said they'd organize it all. And so Ruth and I actually, we kind of come up with these ideas every now and then and put them into action. And that's really happened. And we found a place to hold the workshops. And I said I'd have to have all the equipment. And so it was 2013. And I'd never taught before. And we invested in all the equipment for, you know, up to 14 people. I think we had, you know, 15 kits for 12 people, basically. And found somewhere that would look after them all, and announced it and sold it. And the first bunch came, and it was extraordinary. Yeah, it was, you know, something I've heard other people say. It's very useful to put what you know, to have to put into words and have to kind of format it for people in a workshop. It's a terrific exercise, mm-hmm. you know, for the teacher.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it's a very unsociable thing, painting, and running workshops is very sociable.
It is.
You know, we unlike most of the things you'd attend in the States, you know, it's all in one place. Everybody's been breakfasted and fed, and, you know, evening meals. And we take them on a wine tour for the entire week too, like at the dinner table every evening. So I kind of advertise it as live the life of the Provençal painter, but it's probably a little bit richer than my life generally. Eating well every night and three meals a day, and, you know, drinking fine wines. But it's been great.
This episode is sponsored by Trakel Art Supplies. Trakel has always made it a point to get to know the artists who use their brushes. So I wanted to talk to a few of those artists.
My name is Gray Crayola Simpkins. I'm an artist. I've been working with Trakel for, gosh, it feels like 12 years. I forget the exact amount.
Trakel had gone out to see Greg at his studio to learn how he uses his brushes. They were doing a little research and development to kind of improve their line.
A lot of the brushes I was using, I would damage them pretty hard because, you know, I work pretty hard with the acrylics, and then they wouldn't spring back fast. And I noticed that Trakel brushes, they held up longer, and I was like, well, that's really cool.
They ended up developing a relationship, and pretty soon,
they're like, would you like your own set of brushes? I was like, oh my gosh, that'd be amazing. It's like a skateboarder getting his own skateboard, right?
I wanted to hear it straight from Greg, Trakel's first pro team member. And we'll talk about what that means in another episode. But what I wanted to know was what makes Trakel so different from other brands of brushes that he's used.
They held their point better. I don't know if it's because when I have gone up there and watched them make the brushes, it's all in-house right there. You just see the care that they hand-make each one. So you could just see that they put a lot of love into making their brushes, and it comes out when you're painting.
And don't forget, from now until July 20th, when you use the promo code SAVVYGIFT at checkout, Trakella's going to throw in a free paintbrush for you, so you get to try these out on your own. Trakella's going to throw in a number 6 golden round tacklon brush for you when you use the promo code SAVVYGIFT at checkout. So head on over to Trakella.com, that's T-R-E-K-E-L-L.com, and use promo code SAVVYGIFT.
So I'm really curious about this because I know that there's a lot of artists who have questions about how do you get that, how do you start the workshop? And I think one of the things, at least from what I see, that stops people at first from doing it is kind of what you referred to, that feeling of inadequacy, that who am I to teach what I paint? And I think it's really interesting what you said, because I think I just want to kind of highlight something that you said that I think is super important for this, which is that when I hear at least people struggling with the idea of whether or not to start a workshop, their struggle is, who am I to teach painting? There's so many other painters out there who do it better than I do, perhaps, or blah, 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 like, you know, something along those lines. This idea that they're sort of competing with other people. And so I really like what you said about your students come to you because they see something in your work that they like and that they would like to achieve. And that makes you the only person who could possibly teach it. So to answer the question, who am I? You're the only one that can do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, well, I'm sure that there are other people that could do it, but there's something about, you know, there's something about whatever I offer at my work that they want. It's a certain kind of slapdash quality as well. a certain freedom. I don't know.
Well, there's a looseness to your work, and that's something that I think is very difficult to obtain or to understand, because looseness, when not done well, is just sloppy. Or, you know, other people think that looseness is something that you don't need a lot of skill to do. That I know you were joking when you were saying it, that slapdash, just slap it on there. But you've taken 20 years to learn how to do that.
Yeah, I guess it's always the thing that allows a certain looseness, as long as the drawings are drawing, structure, the usual things, and not that I claim to be any great shakes in those either. But you can. I remember, talking about something like Manet. You know how I think it was Somebody sat for him. He was taking like she said she'd sat 100 times, and he still hadn't got a likeness.
And I'm sorry, did you say Manet?
Manet, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
There's a certain kind of looseness that's actually, it's put on. I don't mean put on like falsely. I mean, it's deliberate. It's part of the process. It's he'd work with a strong structure, but there would be a certain deliberate looseness, unfinishedness, certain kind of, it's not something that just happens, the looseness. And it's not a gimmick or a tick either. It's deliberate. It's built in.
Yeah.
With somebody like Manet, for example.
How about for yourself?
Yeah, it's something I tried to, if you were to take it apart, I mean, we're talking about kind of interesting surfaces, interesting brush strokes. Yeah, this is going to make some people kind of like cringe, the idea of energy and so on. And I'm a great fan of people that can just paint perfectly still, beautifully composed, with light. It doesn't, as long as the light works, it seems to me it doesn't matter if it's loose or tight. That's the thing that makes paintings interesting.
Yeah.
They've been interesting for hundreds of years before even photography existed, is that people made evocations of light, and that's what touches me in paintings. Yeah. So within that, I have very deliberately loosened buttery, God, horrible words. Anyway, deliberately loose strokes. I also quite like the idea that things quite fall apart when you get close to them. It does come down also to partly temperament too. If I take more than a day over a painting, the chances of me finishing it are slimmer. So there's nothing wrong with it, but my temperament doesn't really suit the idea of building up a painting over weeks. mm-hmm. laying it all in and doing undercoats and glazing and so on. It just does not suit my temperament. I'm more of a sort of sword fighting, swashbuckling kind of painter, I guess. Oh my
that's a
God,
great
that's
image.
Also so terrible. It is hilarious. I do paint in tights.
Oh, good. Good. Good to know. And do you have like on your back, like one of those for your brushes, just like they do with the arrows? What are those called?
A quiver. That'd be good. Yeah.
Yes. One thing you were starting to say was that you really like this idea of, or you like the fact that when you look close at a painting, that it sort of starts to disappear or it breaks up in the style of work that you do. So I wanted to let you sort of finish that thought.
Yeah. One of the things I really kind of in my, whilst I am, for want of a better word, self-taught, you know, once the internet kind of got up and going, and now there is such a richness of stuff to study online. And one of the people I referred to quite recently was, or a couple of years ago, was David LaFell and Cheryl.
David LaFell and Sherry McGraw, yes.
Sherry McGraw, yeah. She's talking about the fact that paintings are designed to be seen across a room. If they work up close, that's great, but that's not how they're designed to be seen. Mm-hmm. They're like sort of advertising boards or something. And I love that idea. So I try and I tend to paint at arm's length. You know, I really do fully extended brush and the full length of my arm. And that tends to mean that you're further away. If I'm only working 8x6 or 10x8 or whatever, then you're 6 feet away from the thing. Mm-hmm. And that would be pretty well equivalent to what from the setup. So you'd see things pretty well the same size. And you're forced to kind of paint in a kind of approximate way. You know, you're forced to use larger brush strokes. It's not a sort of minuscule up close kind of a small brush thing. So I've taken that on too, and given that my short attention span, I like to kind of finish things quite. So I guess that idea of that's pretty well how I approach things. Mm-hmm. And whilst being outside, you know, clearly the light changes very quickly, and you've got to be pretty quick, otherwise you're really in trouble. So yeah. That kind of sums up my approach.
Yeah. Well, and that fits perfectly with how you paint, obviously, you know, so you've suited your painting to your temperament.
When I'm painting well, I'd say. I just spent a day in the studio. It's not exactly to how I'd like, but hey, there's always tomorrow.
There is. And this idea that we have to do perfect paintings every time we walk into a studio, I think is probably one of the most damaging myths out there for artists.
That's why I like this idea that you at least learned what you don't want to do.
Yes, that is very
every
good.
Time, you know, it seldom really goes exactly as you want. And no, I really do tend to think of painting as kind of, I wouldn't do anything else, but it's kind of disappointing on a daily basis. A daily painting is like disappointing on a daily basis. There you go, That's a great quote.
Then if that's the case, if it's every day is a disappointment, that's good. That's a great title for your next book, Julian. A painting a day, a recipe for daily disappointment by Julian Merrow Smith.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a depressive person. Well, actually, my wife might have to agree, but no, I mean, it just is that if you're not really, I guess the other day, to somebody quoted it, the idea of, which cellist was it? I can't remember the cellist, but, you know, 90 years old, still practicing every day, and he was asked why he practiced every day, and he said, I think I'm being somewhere. That's the.
Yes.
My wife said that's a misquote, and she's as a cellist, but it seemed like a very good idea at the time.
Well, it's even if it's a misquote, the idea behind it is that painting and music, the arts, are about lifelong learning, and that you can't get too full of yourself nor take yourself so seriously that you ever feel like you've gotten quote there and have nothing left to learn. I think that's the point at which you sort of die as a painter. How's that for depressive?
Yeah, I can't imagine a situation that I can't imagine anybody ever thinking they'd got to a point where they were really lay down the brushes, I'm done.
No, but you do.
That's just gonna, you occasionally hit them out of the park. I think that's the most you can hope for.
Yeah, you feel good about that particular painting. And, you know, for me, when I feel like, okay, I said what I wanted to say, which is sort of the point where that painting is done, I don't feel like, oh my God, I'm so awesome. I'm the most awesome painter in the world or anything like that. I just feel like I picked something up that I can now take with me to the next painting. And it's more an excitement to start the next painting and take what I've learned. It's like if you're a little kid and you just learned a new word, yeah, you're like, yeah, oh, giddy, I get to learn this new, I get to use this new vocabulary. And now I get to go play with that new word or whatever the visual equivalent of that is that made me feel like, okay, I said what I wanted to say in that painting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The thing that I wanted to ask you about this idea that a recipe for daily disappointment, from that perspective, when you do have those like, you see it as now I know what I don't want to do. How do you take that forward? I'm just kind of curious because I think it is so important to know what you don't want to do. And I'd love to hear from you, like when you have these days of that was a disappointment, how do you continue to paint when you're sort of in that mode, if that makes sense?
It's not like wrist-cutting kind of disappointment. What I mean is that it's kind of incremental, you know, it's you're hoping, I think the sporting metaphors are good, you know, that you go to the park and you want to score a home run, you want to hit out of the park and all that kind of stuff. And most days, if you went in there and every day and did that, then wow, you know, then you would be one of the greatest players ever. So it's not like that. So there's always, it's not really, I suppose disappointment is a very strong word. I guess there is a sense that you know you can always do better. And so that every day in the studio is kind of adds to that experience. Let's be kind to ourselves. So I kind of call it mildly disappointing. I mean, it's kind of like, damn, I really wanted to hit that out of the park, and it's not really, it's okay. You know, it'll go on the market, I'll sell it and so on. And I suppose it's that thing of, I know I'm not there yet. Mm-hmm. And of course you will never get it. So that's probably a good thing, but it just means it's like back to the drawing board, you know, and when it's going well, and when you've got time in the studio and you get a good run of work, many days on the trot where you're really trying to, and you're taking problems from one day to the next and you're trying to solve them. And, you know, that's when it's really great. And that doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes it's just you do a day here and didn't feel quite like you wanted it to go. And you have big plans at the start of the day. You know, you really want to do a great painting. And it's seldom the case. It's usually some kind of compromise. That's kind of what I'm really trying to say.
That makes sense.
And that's always slightly disappointing. Not risk cuttingly.
Not risk cuttingly. That's good to hear.
It'll be all right tomorrow.
Exactly.
It's the Beckett quote, you know, is it fail again, fail better. That's really, you know, all you can do. You just keep on, it's just like life, really.
It is. I really think it is. That
every day, just try and be a better human being. And
yeah. If you can get 1% or 2% better than where you were yesterday, then that's a good day.
Not 5% better, yeah.
Just a little bit, because every day...
incremental, like I said, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, but if you think about it, that adds up really quickly.
Yeah, I've heard you do your, you know, the dollar sum thing about savings. I had, you know, and that's true. You think of it the same way. It's like stuff in the bank, you know, hopefully there's... And there's all those cliches. It's two steps forward, one step back. And basically you go on, you keep trying to get better. You trying to focus on what didn't work. Sometimes it's just today, I'm probably just a bit tired and it didn't quite go how I wanted it to go. Other people might be very happy with what I've done. You know, that's the difficulty as well. So it's, I know what I wanted to do. I think I did anyway. And I didn't quite achieve it. So tomorrow.
Exactly. And that, I think that is probably without you knowing it, you've just given a really good example of, to me, what I see as the real difference between like a sort of optimistic versus pessimistic outlook, in the sense that when you're trying to think how I can summarize this pretty quickly, but, you know, optimism versus pessimism, I think usually people assume that optimists only say good things, or they always are sort of Pollyanna-ish, or they bury their heads in the sand, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, a more accurate description of a true optimist isn't that you never say anything that is
negative.
Yeah. Like you mentioned that was sort of depressive or whatever. But I think what's most important is the thought that comes afterwards. So if you feel like I didn't do a great painting today, or I didn't get where I wanted to get today, and the next thought is, and so I'm such a crappy painter, or I'm so, I'm this, I'm that. That's what I would consider to be a very pessimistic view. And that I think is really shooting yourself in the foot and does you no good. Sure. Versus maybe I was tired today. Maybe I didn't have, I didn't have a great day today. That I think is a more optimistic view and a more helpful and healthy view than saying, than immediately coming to this idea that you're not a great painter, or you never will be, and blah, like these ultimatum type statements versus, okay, tomorrow's like exactly what you said. Tomorrow's another day. I can get back in the studio tomorrow and keep moving forward.
Yeah. I had a few years ago, I remember reading, and I didn't know who it was. It was a cartoonist, and he was saying that every morning, every day, even though he's been doing this for however long he'd been doing it, he still didn't know how he did it. And so every day was full of angst about, can he, can't he? And I thought, well, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. There's a certain, every time you go in the studio, you really don't know. Yeah, there are times when you're sort of rolling along and it's going well, and it's almost like having to start afresh every day.
Yeah.
All that learning.
Which is good and bad, right? On the one hand, it's like, yay, it's a new day. Like anything can happen and it's all fresh. And then, oh my God, it's another day. Like, why can't?
Yes.
I've been doing this for so long, and why do I still feel like I don't know what I'm doing?
Yes. A sort of one day long memory, short-term memory thing where everything's wiped clean every day and you groundhog day, the whole day. Yeah,
exactly. which can be good and which can be bad. But I think that's a really important conversation, what you've brought up, because we all go through this, and sometimes it can feel like you're just spinning your wheels. And so I think this idea of taking what you learn from one day into the next is critical to keep us as painters going on. And I think sometimes people don't recognize that.
I think there is also a big thing about momentum. One of the reasons that it's so I can and have gone on for days and days, even in the last couple of months, I've done, where I've done 45 days on the trot, 45 paintings and other paintings in between, whilst not just the day it is. And you really get on a kind of, you become kind of invincible. There's a sort of, there's days where it's less successful, but you really do take stuff with you every day back into the studio, and you feel like, and one of the most difficult things is stopping and starting again. And so one of the reasons that when I do have a good run, and I know that if I stop, it's actually, you stop one day, I miss one day, and I can miss 2 days, and I can miss 3 days, and it becomes easier to miss days than just to start again. And so, I'm on day two now after a week off going to England and so on. And it's difficult to get back on. It's really, to get back on the bicycle, there'll be a point when it starts to flow better, but it's almost, one almost doesn't dare stop because it's so difficult to start again.
Oh, that's so interesting. And I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I was having a similar conversation with a student of mine who had been off painting for like a week or two and was feeling like he couldn't paint anymore because he'd been off for so long, for two weeks. Yeah. So I love another person saying, yeah, this is a thing. This happens. And I think it also speaks to this idea that even if it's only 15 or 20 minutes, doing something every single day just makes your life so much easier in the long run. And again, it's that cumulative thing that we were talking about, that as you continue to paint every day, even if it's just a little bit, that momentum that you build is super valuable. And it starts that flywheel going. It starts you going in the right direction. And that can also go in the opposite direction, which is, you know, that whole inertia versus momentum, right? That it can be the opposite.
I love the flywheel. That's perfect. A great big heavy flywheel that once it's stopped is, you know, not easy to get going again. That's perfect. Yeah. Keep that thing rolling around.
I know.
Like you say, just touching base. You know, that's what it's like. You being in the studio, doing something and just keeping it all. It's also so much a mental thing, you know, your headspace. That's really, for me, I'm living out here in the country. I've got a family and so on, but often I can spend really a couple of weeks just solely in my own head, working through stuff and then going to the studio and working it. And it doesn't make me very easy to live with, but that's just one of those things about it's kind of what you need. And that's real flywheel momentum, I guess.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting what you said, that it doesn't make you very easy to live with. I didn't discover this. My husband pointed it out to me very clearly. That when I don't paint every day, or when I'm not painting, I'm not fun to be around. It's really interesting that the most healthy thing, you know, like for our marriage is for me to paint every single day, because as my husband says, I'm not.
I know it well. It's the friend who I originally came down here to see, you know, 20 years ago, what it was. If I'd get low, he'd say, just, Ben, go and paint, you know.
Yeah.
He'd know full well that it was what threw things out for me. It doesn't always seem like it when you're not doing it. That's the trouble. But other people can tell you that that would be the thing to do. Go back in the studio.
Immediately. Yeah. For God's sakes, please. Here's your paintbrush. Go.
My wife's father's a painter, so she knew what she was getting into.
Yes.
That's my excuse anyway.
My poor husband had no idea, but at least he's observant enough and vocal enough about it to be like, you know what? I think you should paint. And the funny thing is that I think oftentimes artists struggle with this sort of guilt for being an artist and the amount of time that it takes and going in and locking ourselves into our studio. And there's obviously there's extremes to everything. If you're the type of person that's completely ignoring your family and not spending any time with them and locking yourself away and not communicating, that's not what I'm talking about. But what I am talking about is that this idea that we sort of, like, that's who we are as human beings, is we are artists. And when we don't honor that, we tend to become intolerable human beings, you know? And so kind of like the best gift you can give to your family is to take care of yourself, both physically and mentally. And then in the case of most artists, the mental self-care is get in your studio and paint.
Yeah. I saw a documentary about Alice Neal. Is it Alice Neal? Mm-hmm. Neal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, made by her grandson, I think. Yeah, that's good. You should see that if you get a chance to see it. It's extraordinary.
Yes, and from what I haven't seen it, and I would not consider myself an authority on Alice Neal, but from what I've picked up, she was in that other extreme of locking everybody out and just painting. Do I have that right?
She had two kids running around, and
and
they have opinions about it.
Yes,
we're both grown ups now, but obviously.
Yes.
But that's an extreme.
She went to the other extreme of ignoring the family and damaging the people she loved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is not what.
Yeah. Possibly, yeah. I'm trying not to do that.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, Julian, speaking of family, I know you have people out waiting for you to have dinner and all sorts of things and join the party, as it were. So thank you very much for this conversation, for taking the time to talk with me, and for all of the insights that you gave us.
It's great. I hope it was in some small way useful or interesting. It was great to talk, and I'll see you in Italy.
Yes. Thank you so much to Julian for such a great conversation. Go to savvypainter.com for show notes on this episode to connect with Julian and to see his paintings. While you're there, make sure you don't miss an episode of the podcast. Sign up for show updates and free guides at savvypainter.com/subscribe. One more thing I want to let you know. This year, you can expect a lot more workshops from Savvy Painter. If you are an artist who struggles with getting painting time in or feels like you're always busy but never really moving forward with your art, then my workshops just might interest you. Past workshops include Mindset Mastery, a 5-week online workshop to help you get past the roadblocks that keep you from painting. In it, we tackle the inner critic, fears of artists, and setting yourself up for a successful creative day. The workshop, How to Develop a Relationship with the Right Gallery, helped several artists find the right gallery and show their work. So if this is something that interests you, you can go to savvypainter.com/workshop and get on the email list. This is separate from the main list that tells you when a new episode comes out. This is just for the workshop, so you don't get quite as many emails, but when you do, there's always something really good happening. Sign up now and get a downloadable PDF with case studies that tell you exactly how 3 artists pushed through barriers that were getting in the way of their studio time. You can, for example, learn how Rhonda went from not wanting to call herself an artist to getting her very first solo show. Also, listen to an introverted artist describe how she built her confidence and then spoke in front of an audience of her peers. And you can discover the tools that Samantha used to take back her power after a decade of believing that she had no, I'm putting air quotes there, she had no talent. So again, go to savvypainter.com/workshop to reserve your place on the list. When you sign up, you get that downloadable case studies that I mentioned, but more importantly, you get exclusive invites to upcoming workshops. Most of the time when I launch a new program, it sells out before I ever announce it publicly. So reserve your spot now at savvypainter.com/workshop. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thank you so much for listening.